I want to begin by laying before you a couple of indisputable facts. I don't think that anybody would disagree that sometimes traditionalism can be a serious problem. In Matthew, the 15th chapter, Jesus was questioned about why His disciples didn't keep the traditions of the fathers. And He said, your problem is that you have let the traditions of the elders overrule the commandments of God. Sometimes when we get into our ways of doing things, we're actually ignoring God. A second thing that I think is indisputable, that nobody would question, is that lukewarmness is a serious problem and sometimes takes place. Jesus said to the Laodiceans, "You are lukewarm, neither cold nor hot. I'm going to vomit you out of my mouth." It is quite possible for both of these problems to affect us. So what do we do about it? How do we keep traditionalism from becoming a problem? How do we avoid lukewarmness? Well, last week I mentioned a book by Lagard Smith called Radical Restoration, which is largely written out of concern for these kinds of problems. The traditionalism that we sometimes get into, the lukewarmness that sometimes can infect an individual, that can infect an entire church. He is concerned about that. His solution was to radically alter the church as we would know it, to break this up and form little small cell groups, house churches, he calls them. And we began to look at that. And let me remind you, the house church movement, as we'll talk about tonight, is really not about being in a house. Sometimes that's done, sometimes it's not. But the thing that Lagard Smith proposes, it puts great emphasis on the emotions and the feelings of the participants. Edification, rather than worship and praise of God, is the primary purpose for coming together. These house churches typically, at least those influenced by Smith and some others, they may call themselves by different things, but Church of Christ is one thing they will usually not be called by. And here is a crucial point. There is a deliberate, concerted effort to limit the size of churches to a group that would fit inside a home. You know, they may not meet in a home, or they may. But part of it is they must be of that kind of size. The Lord's Supper is the focus of the edification gathering and is usually a meal-sized supper. The worship tends to be pretty informal, spontaneous, and what they term participatory, meaning that a lot of people lead, a lot of people speak. Those are some of the characteristics of house churches. I'm going to take a moment to remind you of some things I talked about last week, not to go over each one, but I'm going to read the verses. The whole house church movement, you cannot deal with it if you don't understand certain important biblical principles. There's an absolute standard. You read through Lagard Smith's material, you listen to some others been influenced by him, and you should be struck by how subjective the approach is. How little there is of a reliance upon the concrete standard of God. There is an absolute standard. Secondly, edification is important, but not to the neglect of worship of God. In fact, when we worship God, that ought to edify one another. Christians, one of the things Smith talks about, makes a contrast between what he called the restorationist, who's the warrior, and the Christian who's interested in sanctification, purity. 1 Timothy 6, verse 12, Christians are to fight the good fight. A Christian is also a warrior. Our worship must be done decently and in order. The idea, I do not read the word spontaneous in the New Testament. I can think of a New Testament church whose worship probably would be characterized as spontaneous. That was a church at Corinth before Paul set things in order with the book of 1 Corinthians. When there are problems, and sometimes there are, you know, one of the things I want us to understand is LaGuard Smith was not totally off base in what he identified as some problems that sometimes beset us. Sometimes we do settle into just a traditional way of doing things. Sometimes lukewarmness does affect Christians. But the answer to that, my brethren, is to be renewed in mind. It is not about manipulating the externals. And that's what this book really does. Tonight I want to talk about some of the more obvious outward changes. And let me just say to you, there are things, as we go through this, I hope you'll notice two things. Some things that are proposed, some things that have been adopted, and trust me, this has had an effect upon churches in various parts of the country. Some of it's just flat wrong. Some of the things Smith advocates are not necessarily wrong, but they're really not the answer. And I hope we can make the distinction between those. I want to talk about the Lord's Supper. LaGuard Smith said that the Lord's Supper was instituted in the context of a shared meal. That is, Jesus and the apostles were together eating, and they ate the Lord's Supper then. And so therefore, today when we eat the Lord's Supper, it should be in the context of we're eating together, a regular meal. He says in 1 Corinthians 11 that all Paul was doing was there were some people abusing the common meal. And the folks he told to eat at home were really the ones that were just making pigs of themselves. They were the ones that were told to take it home. In Jude 12, it mentions love feast. He says the love feast is that common meal, that fellowship meal, and the Lord's Supper should be a part of that. We're having a meal, and then during the meal, we eat the Lord's Supper, and then we resume the regular meal. That is his teaching. I want you to look at this quote. The Lord's Supper gave meaning to their table fellowship, and their table fellowship gave meaning to the Lord's Supper. Each was a picture of the other. Let that sink in for a moment. By table fellowship, he means just eating a common meal together. That's what gave meaning to the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper gave meaning to their table fellowship. I'm going to come back to this in a moment, but I want you to just stop for a moment. Do your antennas go up sometimes? Table fellowship. Do you ever remember reading that expression in the New Testament? Do you ever remember reading folks eating together called table fellowship? Just think about that. Now, there are others who reject LaGuard Smith's idea of the fellowship meal that surrounds the Lord's Supper. And yet, some of them say the Lord's Supper itself ought to be more meal-sized. In fact, the one thing, and I don't want to misrepresent Brother Smith, but he's not always real consistent, and sometimes he's a little tough to follow. He says the Lord's Supper itself should be an actual food and drink meal, not a token ritual with our typical 21st century crackers and grape juice. He has us eating a full meal that surrounds the Lord's Supper, and the Lord's Supper being a full-size meal too. That's a lot of eating. You know, that's what. But there are others who say, no, we're not going to do the fellowship part. But one preacher said, the word supper to him meant a full meal. He told about a church where they'd set baskets of bread on the table and they had the grape juice was in pitchers and people poured glasses of it. And said, that's the way we should do it. Some people ridicule what we practice. Call it, oh, those are the pinch and sip brethren. They just pinch and sip. Well, let me look at this with you quickly. The fellowship meals. Turn to 1 Corinthians 11. Put your finger there. Put your marker there. We're going to come back to this several times. 1 Corinthians 11. I suggest to you that verses 17 through 34 are divided into three parts. The first section, Paul says there is division and there shouldn't be. When you come together, verse 17, it's not for the better but for the worse. For first of all, when you come together as a church, I hear that there are divisions among you, and in part, I believe it. Verse 20, therefore, when you come together in one place, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper, for in eating, each one takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry and another is drunk. What? Do you not have houses to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing? What shall I say to you? Shall I praise you in this? I do not praise you. The first point he makes is you don't care about one another. You are divisive in the things you are doing. Then he says, the way you remember Jesus, and he tells them, this is what the Lord did. He took bread, verse 23. Verse 24, he gave thanks. He broke it. He said, take and eat of it. This is my body. Do this in remembrance of me. Similarly, he did the cup. He goes on to tell them, he said, when you eat the bread, you drink the cup, you examine yourself. And the idea really here, I think, is not so much that you look into your life and see, is my life perfect? It is the idea, are you doing this in remembrance of Jesus? He said, you're to discern the body and blood of Jesus. He says, this is how you eat the Lord's Supper. And then he comes back at the very end. He says, if you're hungry, eat at home. We've not come together to satisfy our hunger. We've come together to remember Jesus. You know, Smith says that the Lord's Supper is eaten as part of this bigger fellowship meal. And yet, you never read of anything other than the bread and the fruit of the vine. Back in the 10th chapter, he speaks of the cup, he speaks of the bread, he never mentions the meat, the fish, the eggs, the cheese, the nuts, you know, whatever. Not mention any of the other components of the meal. It's just never there. Somebody says, but what about, doesn't Jude 12 talk about a love feast? Yes, it does. Jude 12. These are spots in your love feast. While they feast with you without fear, serving only themselves, they are clouds without water, carried about by the winds. And he goes on. Love feast in Jude 12. That's it. What does it say? What does that mean? Well, Smith, he tells us that the love feast was a common meal that was eaten in conjunction with the Lord's Supper. Now, what's his proof of that? The main proof he found of it is he quoted A.T. Robertson in his, The Word Pictures of the New Testament. And A.T. Robertson says it means a common meal that was eaten with the Lord's Supper. The thing is, that is based upon 2nd and 3rd century writings. We do find that in the 2nd and 3rd century, this was the practice of the churches. But was it practiced in the 1st century? If that's what was going on, if the love feast of Jude 12 means a common meal that was supposed to be eaten in and around the Lord's Supper, then the Apostle Paul got it all wrong in 1 Corinthians 11. He did not tell the people in 1 Corinthians 11, look, you folks are making pigs of yourselves, go easy on the gluttony. He didn't say to them, make sure that you share. He said, you have houses to eat and drink in. If you're hungry, eat at home. There are three possibilities for Jude 12 that fit the rest of the New Testament. It's just a simple rule of Bible study. You come across an obscure reference, an obscure phrase, love feast. The word, actually, the Greek word is agape in the plural form. What does it mean? Well, you have to interpret it in the light of the rest of the New Testament. Christians did eat together. They weren't part of the church gathering. 1 Corinthians 11 says you eat at home. But Acts 2 verse 46, Christians broke bread from house to house. In 1 Corinthians 5, and I want you to see this passage, the same book that says if you're hungry, eat at home, is talking about a brother, a Christian. This man had taken his father's wife. Paul said he's to be put out of your assembly. You're no longer to keep company with him. And he says in verse 10, and I'm not talking about you don't keep company with the people of this world who are sinners. But verse 11, not with a brother, not even to eat with such a person. What you don't do in verse 11 with the brother that's a fornicator, you can do with the people of the world. If this was a meal associated with the Lord's Supper, you don't do that with those of the world. But we eat with those of the world. We have associations with them. Christians sometimes eat together. And my point would be, if this man, this brother is caught up in fornication, you don't eat with him. But I'll eat with others. Friday night I eat with a group of Christians. All along I do that with others. That's a good thing. I don't know, but what Jude 12 might not refer to the Lord's Supper itself. There is no greater feast we have than when we take of the bread and the fruit of the vine. Or what about John 6? I think one of the problems people have today is, I mean, to them, love feast has to be, it has to be carnal food, physical food they put in their mouth, for the same reason that the people of John 6 had a problem. They came to Jesus saying, you know, we'd like bread from heaven again. You know, Moses gave bread from heaven. How about bread? Jesus said, I'm the bread of life. I want you to eat my flesh. I want you to drink my blood. And what did they do? They turned and they walked away. Can we appreciate a spiritual feast? Now, which one of these is it? I'm not certain. I know it's not the fellowship meal that the guard Smith speaks of, because Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 11 that's not what it was. Let's look at the Lord's Supper itself, though. Should it be a meal? If somebody gets hung up on supper, they've missed the point. The whole point of the Lord's Supper is about remembrance. Physical hunger, as we've already noted, 1 Corinthians 11, you have houses to eat and drink in. If you're hungry, eat at home. My friends, the Lord's Supper is about remembering Jesus. Do this in remembrance of me. This do as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. You proclaim the Lord's death till He comes. Let a man examine himself, so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. And my question, how much does it take to remember Jesus? It takes a pretty good bit to satisfy my hunger sometimes. But if I'm talking about the purpose of the supper is to remember Jesus, how much does it take? How much did Jesus give the apostles that night? And the honest truth is, I don't know. Do you want to eat a little bigger piece of bread than we typically eat? That's fine. In fact, if you've ever, the men who have served will know, some people break off bigger pieces than others. That's immaterial. One of my problems is, why are we dividing churches over an issue that God has not even addressed? The amount of bread, ridiculing the pinch and sip brethren, when what we need to be doing is, let a man examine himself so let him eat of the bread. But can I tell you something on a practical level? I think that instead of helping greater portions of the kind that we're talking about, putting the basket on the table, we're talking about putting up the pitcher, could actually become a hindrance. My dad's very favorite pie was sweet potato. Now, I like sweet potato pie. That wasn't my favorite. That was his. I can easily envision a scenario where maybe next Thanksgiving we're sitting around and my mother's made a sweet potato pie and we get that pie out and, you know, we all get ourselves a slice of that and we start talking about Daddy and how never did care much for Irish potatoes. We ate more rice than we did Irish potatoes. You know, he liked sweet potatoes though. He loved sweet potatoes. Any way you fixed them. Like that sweet potato. And we, you know, we eat a piece of that pie and we talk about him a little while and then I notice, you know, over there in the hutch, there's another piece, another pie. And I say, you know, hand me that other pie. I think I'm going to eat another piece of that pie. And, you know, my brother says, well, let me go get the Cool Whip. And, you know, my sister says, well, I'm going to make some coffee. And, you know, what? Pretty soon, we're eating pie because we like pie. You know, we're not remembering anymore. You start having great big sections of bread and juice, and is it not likely that at some point you've lost the point of what you're doing? Let me make it clear again. If somebody has more bread than what we typically have, that's not wrong. But it's not wrong to have the amount we do. But you increase the size, you may not be solving the problem you intended to solve after all. You may just be making it worse and becoming more of a distraction. Well, let me look at the second part of this tonight, the house churches. Smith says we need to be in smaller groups. In Romans, the 16th chapter, he makes the observation that not all the Christians in Rome worshipped together. For he's writing to the saints at Rome, and he says, greet Priscilla and Aquila. Verse 5, greet the church that is in their house. The city of Rome was estimated in the first century to have had a population in excess of 1 million. Some estimates run as high as 1,500,000. No, I don't expect that the saints scattered around a metropolitan area that large all met in one place. I think he's right in that they would have probably met in different places. But I want you to note what he really is pushing for. He said, the issue is not whether we meet in an actual house as opposed to a church building. Rather, it's the contrast between small versus large, participant versus spectator, active versus passive, personal versus impersonal. It's simply axiomatic. The larger the gathering, the less personal, interactive, and truly participatory it's likely to be. He's not saying, well, you know, obviously in a metro area that size, it wouldn't be practical for people who live on the south side of Rome to be able to meet with brethren who live all the way on the north side. So naturally they cluster together more geographically. No, he said, there's a deliberate effort. You've got to keep it very small. If it's not small, it's impersonal. You become spectators. You become passive. You're not participating. He suggests that in a city that's got various house churches, that there would be a group of elders over the whole city. The elders would, and I'll come back to that in a few moments. Let me ask, where did New Testament churches meet? Some of them met in houses. And I don't want to sound facetious, but does Brother Smith not recognize a lot of churches that we know of today started in houses or storefronts or in small places? I don't know anybody that says when that's the most expedient thing to do. that there's anything wrong with that. But if you continue to read in your Bible, they didn't always meet in houses. They weren't always small enough to meet in houses. In Acts 2:46, they continued daily with one accord in the temple. In chapter 5, verse 12, it says they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. That was a covered portico in the temple. Now, how many people are there at this time? Well, they started with 3,000. Acts 4, verse 4, number of men was 5,000. But it says they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. It doesn't say they were scattered about the city in house churches. They were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. Were they passive spectators in an impersonal church? I don't think so. Some years later, you know, the church at Jerusalem scatters. But by Acts 15, they have come to be described as a multitude. Look at Acts 15 and verse 4. When they had come to Jerusalem, they were received by the church, the apostles, and the elders. And then in verse 5, verse 12, as they are addressing the church, it says, then all the multitude kept silent. I don't imagine they were still meeting in the temple. You know, there's been this great persecution that's caused them to scatter once before they regathered. Wherever they met, it was a place big enough that apostles, elders, visitors, a group big enough to be called a multitude could gather. You come to Ephesus. Where does it say they met? It speaks of the school of Tyrannus. Paul had enough success in the city of Ephesus, you remember, that the silversmith started getting worried. Do you ever read of church plural? Now again, Ephesus was a large city. There may have been some disciples that met, you know, because of distance, had to meet somewhere else. But I'll tell you something, the singular is always used. The elders were to oversee the flock. They were made overseers of the church, singular. He never talks about a cluster of churches they oversaw. The third story at Ephesus held a pretty large number of people. Took a lot of lamps to light it up. But the best evidence is Corinth. Corinth was big enough that they were in danger of dividing into four different factions. Now I know it theoretically is possible that you could take four people and divide them into four factions. But that your group is in danger of dividing into one group following Paul, one Apollos, one Cephas, and one still saying, well, we're of Jesus, would indicate that's got to be a fairly decent-sized group. In chapters 12 and 14, he talks about the various gifts. And I get the impression there were a good many people. He had to tell the men with tongues that only two or at the most three can speak in any assembly. And those were prophecy. Again, at the most two or three. It was a pretty good-sized group. And where did they meet? I don't know. It was someplace big enough to hold a lot of people. It was, according to 1 Corinthians 11, made to be a different place than their at home. And in chapter 14, let me make sure you notice this in verse 23. Therefore, if the whole church comes together in one place and all speak with tongues, and he goes on, he said, people are going to say you're out of your mind. The whole church came together. New Testament churches weren't always these small, intimate affairs that Smith talks about. I said last week, and I'm going to say this again. You can choose to to be a spectator if you want to be. Your attendance and your part in this group here can be very passive, but that's your choice. You are encouraged when we sing to sing with all your heart. You are encouraged to join in the praying. You are encouraged, whether you are male or female, to think along with us, to study along with us. If you wonder about things you can be doing Monday through Saturday that will be an effective part of building up this church and you don't know what they are, check with the elders, check with the deacons. In many ways, the larger a group gets, the more opportunities are created. Yes, in some ways, the number of out-in-front opportunities are diminished. You know, if you're in a congregation with three men, obviously you're going to lead singing more often, you're going to lead prayer more often. But in a large group, there are plenty of opportunities to serve and to worship, to be a participant. Don't think that being larger means you have to be a spectator. That's your choice, if you make that choice. And I hope you don't. I want to talk very quickly about elders. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this point. There's some things he said that are worth our consideration. He said that sometimes churches choose men more for worldly success, or he makes it as though this is generally the case, more for worldly success. He says most elders are no more than a corporate board of directors. They are not shepherds. And then he advocates the elders overseeing all the house churches on a citywide basis, much like is done in the International Churches of Christ, what used to be called the Boston Movement. I hope you can understand this little chart. If I can remember how to do the laser, I'll do that. I want you to understand what he is saying. This large pie here, pie chart, that's the urban church. That's the church, say, in Athens. And the church in Athens is actually composed of a church on the north side of town, another church on the south side. Oh, there's one on the west and one on the east, and there's a church in the central part of town. These all are, you know, small groups that meet together and function, and yet what we've got over here is one eldership that's going to oversee all five churches. And what can happen is, you may just have one elder out of that church and one elder out of the other church, and they pool together and they oversee all the churches. Well, see, sometimes it's kind of confusing terminology. Each one of those little sections is a church, but you have to add all five sections to get the church. It's churches and church and... Let me just tell you this, some things before, come back to that in a moment. Smith says, you know, we need to keep churches no more than 40 or 50 people. Do you really think we're going to have a lot of churches with elders if that's the way we limit it? 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 tell us what it takes to be a qualified shepherd over God's people. If we arbitrarily limit our churches in size, we diminish the number with elders. Though he doesn't state it, I suspect that's one of the reasons that Smith has advocated this citywide eldership. He realizes that when you limit the pool to just 40 or 50 total members, you're going to have trouble finding elders. So we'll expand the pool. But you limit the size of churches, then you just won't have many elders. He's right, the worldly success should not be the standard. What's the standard? The standard is the Word of God. Titus 1. You know what it says. For this reason I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. And he begins to name the things. And he said, this is the way it is to be. But let me ask you this. You know, it's real easy to get on a rant and talk about things, but sometimes the reason a man had worldly success, if you want to call it that, is because he was talented, hardworking. And yes, some people, that's what all they devote their talents and hard work to. But sometimes people that have that talent and that hard work in the business world bring it to the church. And they may also be very successful in spiritual matters. I don't want to assume a man was appointed for the wrong reason just because he's successful in his business endeavors. That may not be why he was appointed an elder. Elders are to be shepherds, but they're also to be overseers. Truth often lies between two extremes. There are elders that function just like a corporate board of directors. They sit back and they make decisions about how the company is to be run. And that's not the biblical picture of elders. The picture of shepherds who are watching for souls. But it also uses the term overseer. It talks about them as leaders. Elders are more than just men who set a good example for us. They are men who have a certain authority. This idea of multi-church elders is just as unscriptural as it can be. It's one of the most puzzling things to me when I read the book. When I got to that point, I was just shocked. The whole point is, let's just divide up, let's get the churches smaller and smaller, and then all of a sudden we start having citywide elders. And I'll tell you, some of his argumentation would lead you to believe he wouldn't be totally against having national elders. You know, no, he never advocates that. You read in the Bible, elders oversee the flock among them. Acts 20, 28. They are leaders of the flock to which they are an example. When you have Smith's idea of elders, you've got men overseeing churches they don't even assemble with. A citywide eldership, that's just not the biblical pattern. One of his proofs of that, he said, Titus 1:5, he said, ordain elders in every city. Acts 14:23, he said they ordained elders in every church. If a city only has one church. But, you know, I mean, just imagine in today's scenario, if I came to Athens and I ordained elders in Athens, at Westview and at Eastside and Pepper Road and Market Street, and elders in every city just means in whatever churches are there. No New Testament church is ever made up of smaller churches. That pie chart is as far from the picture in the New Testament as you can get. Pepper Road is not a part of the Athens church. Pepper Road, the Pepper Road Church of Christ, is a group of Christians who serve God under the headship of Jesus Christ and are not a part of anything else. We're not a part of the Athens Church with the Athens oversight. We're not part of the North Alabama Fellowship of Churches. We are a group of disciples following Jesus. Noble aims, but a misguided approach. The Lord's Supper, let's make sure we know what it's about. It's about remembering Jesus. There's a time to satisfy our hunger, but that's not what the Lord's Supper is about. The whole concept of the modern fellowship meal, whereby the churches build kitchens and have fellowship halls, and that's not scriptural. Not even biblical at all. The place of meeting is not the issue. Please understand, my objection is not at all to somebody meeting in a house or a storefront. I've met in both. My objection is to an arbitrary, misguided restriction on the size of churches. Elders, make sure you oversee only the flock among you. Traditionalism, lukewarmness, it can be a problem. But we've got to keep our minds renewed, our principles scriptural. Remember Jesus. That's what the Lord's Supper is about. Maybe you've never come to Jesus, though. Maybe you've never yet rendered obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let me ask you, why not? The Lord's Supper, it's about the death of Jesus. For a moment now, I want you to go ahead and open to 454. If you're not a Christian, I want you to take this moment. Think of nothing else but Jesus and His death on the cross. And I want you to ask yourself why He did that. Why did He die? And I want you to realize the answer is for you. You need to be obedient to Jesus Christ. Won't you come while we stand, while we sing together?